Hello, everyone. I'm Camille Nelson Cotton from Massachusetts General Hospital, where I am the Clinical Director of Transplant and Immunocompromised Host Infectious Diseases. And I will be speaking to you today on the Review of Basics Transplant Infectious Disease. As you can see, I have a few conflicts of interest to disclose. And overall, what I hope you will learn today is about the types of immunosuppression seen with organ and stem cell transplant, the timeline of infection after transplant, and I'll have significant discussion around prevention, as I think prevention and prophylaxis is where we really want to focus our attention in avoiding problems whenever possible. I'll also discuss infectious disease syndromes in the transplant setting, optimal use of diagnostics, treatment, latest strategies for prevention, recognition, diagnosis, and treatment based on guidelines, and then best practices for safety and practice improvement. This is sort of a boot camp talk, and it is meant to be an introduction, overview, or review, and will help link to subsequent similar talks. Just to highlight that in the United States at this point, close to 7% of the population identifies as immunosuppressed based on a recent CDC population survey. So that's 4.4% reported an immunosuppressive condition, 3.9% take an immunosuppressive medication, and 1.8% report both. So that is a significant chunk of the population. And then of those immunocompromised patients, a significant number have undergone either organ or stem cell transplant. During the COVID-19 pandemic, we worked to refine definitions of moderate to severe immunocompromise. And that includes these transplant populations, as you can see here highlighted in blue, solid organ transplant and taking immunosuppression, or people who have undergone hematopoietic stem cell transplant within 2 years of transplantation, or who are taking moderate or are taking immunosuppressive therapy, or people who've had CAR T cell treatment, as well as extensive other populations, but I won't be focusing on those today. And the Infectious Disease Society of America went on and further defined those immunocompromised populations and said that the higher risk immunocompromised patients included stem cell transplant within the first 2 years and lung transplant recipients. Moderate risk includes solid organ transplant recipients other than lung transplant. And then lower risk immunocompromised patients includes people with cirrhosis and end-stage renal disease. I think this is really important to highlight that patients heading into solid organ and hematopoietic stem cell transplant are actually immunocompromised prior to transplant, even if they are not on active immunosuppressive therapy. We know that especially those with end-stage liver disease have significant net state of immunosuppression, as they can develop things like cryptococcal disease and other infectious processes that belie the extent of their immunosuppression. Fortunately, in our Yellow Book chapter, we did define who is less immunocompromised, and this is always helpful. And this includes stem cell transplant recipients who are more than 2 years out from transplant, not on immunosuppressive therapies, and don't have graft versus host disease. So not all transplant infectious disease is created equal, for sure. There's a great concept that I would like to share with you, developed by Dr. Robert Rubin at my hospital, who described this net state of immunosuppression. And I use this every single day when thinking about patients. Immunosuppression is a composite of risk factors and includes, first, their disease state. Do they have an autoimmune disease or advanced organ failure or other organ compromise, all of which can contribute to augmented immunosuppression? Do they have comorbidities and conditions, diabetes, obesity, malnutrition, hypogammaglobulinemia, viral infections, an altered microbiome, or advanced age that also contribute? And then, of course, the exogenous immunosuppression. And that's an easy one. We know that people on immunosuppression are more immunocompromised, but it's all of these things added together along with the details of the dosing of the immunosuppression, et cetera. So I think it's important to think about the patients holistically when calculating their net state of immunosuppression and the overall risk for various opportunistic and other infections. Just to highlight that with stem cell transplant, there are two main types. One is autologous, which is their own stem cells are collected. They get high-dose chemotherapy and they get their own cells back. So that's a lower infectious risk. Allogeneic stem cell transplant is a higher infectious disease risk. And this is where there's actually a true transplant from someone else to the recipient. And there are various types of transplant available. Sometimes the devil's in the details, so I would encourage you to talk with the oncology team if you have questions about an individual stem cell transplant recipient, but just know that allogeneic is higher risk for infection compared with autologous. In the United States, from 2019 through 2023, it looks as though we did a grand total of almost 114,000 stem cell transplants. These were primarily the lower infectious disease risk, autologous at 66,000 versus over 47,000 allogeneic. So just be aware of those numbers. And then one of the more helpful things is thinking about the timeline of infection after transplant and knowing that for stem cell transplant, within the first 30 days, this is where they have neutropenia, mucositis, catheters, graft versus host disease, and can have higher risks of all types of infection from bacterial to viral to fungal. And then there's sort of the next phase would be the early engraftment phase or days 30 through 100, and then the late post-engraftment phase, which is more than 100 days out. And as you can see here, there are various infections that happen at different times and worthwhile thinking about optimal prevention of infection, prophylaxis, routine testing, and then if you are seeing someone in that window phase, what should you be testing for? And so I think this is an important framework to use when we're thinking about this situation. So what types of immunosuppression are used after allogeneic stem cell transplants? This includes chemotherapy. And then there can be a whole host of medications listed there for graft versus host disease prophylaxis and also for graft versus host disease treatment. The usual first line treatment is methylprednisolone, but you can see people might be on a lot of different things for prophylaxis. I wanted to highlight that many of the people undergoing stem cell transplant are also getting CAR T cell therapy. They may have had it, before, or they may end up getting CAR T cell therapy. It's all kind of a continuum for therapy, and there are different protocols and different details. Be aware that CAR T cell therapy can be profoundly immunosuppressive and often causes cytopenia. And roughly a third of patients getting CAR T cell therapy may suffer a bacterial infection within the first 30 days. Viral infections can be severe. Fortunately, CMV and HHV6 have been shown to be quite rare overall, and fungal infections are uncommon. It's also important to realize that there can be off-target effects that can cause toxicity and adverse events, including cytokine release syndrome and immune effector cell neurotoxicity syndrome. So do be aware that there's some ID mimics with CAR T cell therapy. I also just wanted to mention bispecific antibody therapy and infections. These are quite immunosuppressive and overall can convey a significantly higher risk of infection, so do be aware of that. Regarding organ transplant, so we're better than ever before. If we look at the global report from 2024, there were over 173,000 organ transplants throughout the world, predominantly kidney transplant, also liver transplant, but vigorous active programs in multiple places throughout the world. In 2025, we had our best year ever for organ transplant as far as volume at over 49,000 organ transplants in the United States. More than half of those are kidneys, and about a quarter are liver transplants. And we're also going gangbusters this year. We have had over 1 million transplants done in the United States since 1988. So this is really a burgeoning population out there. Common immunosuppression after organ transplant, I always think that it is induction, sort of the immediate post-transplant immunosuppression, where we often try to sort of ablate the immune system so that there's not acute rejection. And sometimes we use T cell depleting agents like antithymocyte globulin or alemtuzumab, or the IL-2 antagonist basiliximab. And then people go on to chronic immunosuppression, which commonly these days is triple immunosuppression with prednisone, tacrolimus, and mycophenolate. Those details may vary depending on where you are in the world and your local program and the organ. But triple is quite common, and often that gets weaned over the first few years after transplant. Similar to what I showed you for the bone marrow transplant timeline, there's an excellent timeline of infection after organ transplantation, where we think about that first month after transplant, which is often when we see nosocomial or technical issues causing infection. And then the first 1 to 6 months after transplant is when we tend to see either activation of latent infections or opportunistic infections. And as you can see highlighted in green, with good prophylaxis, we still see other infections that you should be aware of. But without prophylaxis, we see things like pneumocystis and CMV and hepatitis B that we really shouldn't be seeing. But that's often in those first 6 months after transplant. And then more than 6 months after transplant is when we tend to see more community-acquired infections, but we can also see some of the late opportunistic infections at that point. So things change over time. Sometimes I always say sometimes the pathogens don't read the rule book, so they appear at the wrong time in the timeline of infection. So just always eyes wide open and expect the unexpected. Just thinking about things that could be on the boards because they are now pretty much accepted as standard of care, but we are widely using hepatitis C donors into positive or negative organ transplant recipients. And they may be antibody or viral load nucleic acid testing positive. And then we usually treat post-transplant, and virtually 100% clearance rates are seen. And so this is now something with very good outcomes. It's allowed us to greatly increase our organ, the pool of organ donors. Roughly 15% of people in my region are positive for hepatitis C. So when we were not using those donors, it really meant a significant reduction in organ donors. But now that we're using them with very good safety and clinical outcomes, we've really expanded the organ pool. Similarly, based on work done by Dr. Elmi Muller in Cape Town, South Africa, where she started using HIV positive donors for HIV positive recipients and showed overall very good graft and patient survival outcomes, we are now using HIV positive donors for HIV positive recipients in the United States. This was initially the HOPE Act, which allowed us to do this work, which had previously been prohibited by federal law. And many programs now are using this as standard of care for kidney and liver transplant recipients. For thoracic transplant recipients, it still needs to be research only. And what's really interesting from this data is about half of these organ donors turn out to have false positive HIV reporting or testing. So when confirmatory testing is done, you know, which takes sometimes days or weeks, and we certainly don't have that time frame prior to organ transplant, they found that about half of them had false positive HIV. So this is a way to capture many more organ donors, including half of these organ donors who turn out to not have HIV. It allows much more rapid transition to transplant within the first. Within 4.5 years, 70% of these HOPE candidates underwent kidney transplant, compared to 43% who were non-HOPE Act kidney transplant candidates. And it also allowed them to have a lower rate of death or removal from the wait list. So overall, much better acquisition of transplant with very good clinical outcomes. Okay, let's talk about prevention and prophylaxis for solid organ transplant. So I am a big fan of the pre-immunosuppression evaluation. And if you aren't routinely doing this for your organ transplant candidates, I think it's something to think about because we really provide an excellent level of safety and overall better outcomes. This is a time where we look at vaccination status and update those. We screen for latent infections. We develop a plan for chronic or recurrent infections. And then we optimize issues like diabetes. We tell them to stop smoking marijuana, and then educate against illness. So I think this is a real window of opportunity. Furthermore, I just wanted to highlight, you'll see through this talk, I have multiple pearls to emphasize important aspects of the talk. But pre-immunosuppression vaccination optimizes vaccine immunogenicity. So this is a really important window for optimizing response to vaccination and subsequent protection against vaccine-preventable illness. It also may be the only time to safely give live viral vaccines like MMR, varicella, or yellow fever vaccines. So it is a real window of opportunity. This is the type of thing we see. This is a 48-year-old man who was referred for routine kidney transplant evaluation. He was originally from rural El Salvador. This is just someone from clinic. He had a positive treponemal antibody with an RPR that was positive at 1 to 16, no history of treatment. He was diagnosed with late latent syphilis and was treated with weekly benzathine penicillin times 3. He had significant Strongyloides antibody positivity and an 18% eosinophilia. So we treated him with ivermectin daily times 2, waited 2 weeks, and then repeated 2 more doses. And then he was hepatitis B core antibody positive. So the plan was to monitor by hepatitis B DNA testing every 3 months after transplant. That's our local protocol. He also had a positive T-spot TB with scattered calcified granulomas on chest CT scan and was diagnosed as having latent TB, for which we gave him 9 months of isoniazid and vitamin B6. And then he had a positive Chagas antibody. Rural El Salvador is the key there. And we did routine monitoring after transplant, and he did not reactivate, similar to roughly 75% of kidney transplant recipients who did not reactivate. And then he was poorly vaccinated, so we took that opportunity to update all of his vaccines. So this is actually my dot phrase from clinic. Sometimes when I give talks, people find it helpful when I include what I'm actually doing. And you can see this is a very New England focused dot phrase. But basically, for those of you using Epic, you know, the 3 stars means I'm just going through this and filling in the blanks as I meet with the patient and their family. But basically, you can see that I'm doing routine screening for various epidemiologic issues. And if they signal, you know, yes, that they eat raw oysters, that's a good time to talk about the risk of foodborne illness. What about cold cuts and the risk of listeria, et cetera? So there's a lot to do when we see these folks. And so I find this a helpful phrase. If you'd like a copy of this, you're welcome to email me, and I'm happy to share this with you by email. So here's the testing, like in our smart phrase, so-called smart phrase that we use. All this testing on the left is what is routinely done for transplant recipients. And I just wanted to highlight that this is the opportunity to provide them with vaccination if they are seronegative for hepatitis A, hepatitis B, varicella, or mumps, measles, rubella. We also do some additional screening if there are risk factors, such as coccidioides, if they've spent significant time in the American Southwest, Strongyloides, if they have epidemiologic risk. And for some of you working in the United States or elsewhere, you may decide to screen everyone because you may be in a higher Strongyloides region. And then Chagas disease, we screen people either from Central or South America or Mexico, or who were born to a mother from those regions. So here's the routine recommendation scheme from the ACIP. This is last year because so far the current ACIP has not released an updated version of this. But you can see this is done by age. My favorite is actually table 2, where they have immunocompromising conditions. And you can see here that there are various vaccines that should not be given to transplant recipients, such as live influenza, MMR, and varicella. And then I like this slide because on the right, you can actually see chronic liver disease, kidney failure, heart or lung disease as various categories and what you can and cannot give during those times. I also want to highlight, as you can see here, there are some additional travel-related vaccines that are contraindicated for transplant recipients because they are live vaccines. And this is from our Yellow Book chapter, which is available online. I'm sure I don't have to tell this audience, but the CDC says that people with HIV or another medical problem that weakens the immune system should be tested for tuberculosis. So that's pretty straightforward. Anyone who is undergoing transplant should be tested. We are seeing a lot more TB than ever before in the United States. I'm sure you're all familiar with that. And I wanted to emphasize that in addition to sending, the blood tests like an interferon gamma release assay, really important to take a good medical history, review epidemiologic risk factors, talk about prior skin test results, look at radiographic findings. And one of my pearls is that I find it really useful in the electronic medical record in the search bar to look for granuloma. That sometimes it's hard to pick out from the wealth of information at our fingertips. But when I see granuloma, I do ponder whether that might be the might be evidence of prior tuberculosis exposure. I think we're all pretty familiar with T-spot TB and or QuantiFERON TB Gold. This is quite specific for Mycobacterium tuberculosis complex organisms. It is not positive from prior BCG vaccination. And then important to realize that with the QuantiFERON testing, indeterminate results do not mean borderline. That means the assay did not work. And also be aware that this testing has a much higher rate of false negative results in immunocompromised patients. So your patient has latent tuberculosis. Should and when should you start chemoprophylaxis? When can immunosuppressive medications be started? And for time, I'll just say the right answer here is really start TB chemoprophylaxis as soon as possible as per guidelines. Make sure they don't have any evidence of active disease, and you can start immunosuppression at any time. B is wrong. Avoid TB chemoprophylaxis. Too many side effects and too much hassle. That'll get you in some hot water. Although sometimes I do have too many side effects and I have to either delay or not use chemoprophylaxis, but I try to not do that as much as possible. And then C is wrong. Most of my patients had BCG vaccine as child and test false positive as older adults. I don't give TB chemoprophylaxis. Actually, if they got BCG vaccine, it's probably because they're in an area with much higher rates of active tuberculosis. And so it's more likely that they had prior exposure. BCG vaccine only covers for a few years and in early childhood. One of the things to emphasize is that excellent prophylaxis is paramount clinically, but also provides important clues for boards questions. So when it is part of a boards question, if they include antivirals or pneumocystis or toxoplasmosis prophylaxis or antifungal prophylaxis, they are signaling to you that if the organism is covered by the prophylaxis, it's probably not the infection they have. Okay, so they're kind of giving you a clue. If they're on, say, voriconazole, they probably don't have aspergillus. If they're on trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, they're signaling that there's a good chance it's not nocardia. I will tell you that in real life, that's not always true. So don't necessarily trust it, but for the boards, it is they are trying to help you and lead you. Let's talk about CMV, probably my favorite pathogen. So CMV, after solid organ transplant or stem cell transplant, we usually do antiviral prophylaxis for 3 to 6 months using either valganciclovir after solid organ transplant or letermovir after stem cell transplant. Sometimes programs do weekly monitoring for sort of 12 to 16 weeks after transplant. And if CMV is detected, they initiate treatment until the infection has resolved. Both of these are generally considered appropriate therapies, except in thoracic organ transplants. There's also something that came out of the second version of the CMV guidelines that I found really helpful, and that now we have increased the strength of the recommendation. But basically, we do this hybrid strategy where we do 3 to 6 months of CMV prophylaxis. And at the end of prophylaxis, we start monitoring for about 12 weeks, measured weekly for 12 weeks. And when there's a low but significant amount of, hopefully low, but significant amount of CMV, we initiate treatment. And this has really helped us avoid severe life-threatening CMV, especially in the higher risk populations. I don't use this for everyone, but I do use it when it in the solid organ recipient who is donor positive recipient negative, or on more potent immunosuppression, or in general who has that high state of high net state of immunosuppression. I wanted to highlight that in 2023, there was publication of the letermovir versus valganciclovir trial for high risk donor positive recipient negative kidney transplant recipients, where overall they saw similar rates of CMV disease and somewhat lower rates of leukopenia and neutropenia in the letermovir arm versus the valganciclovir arm, and fewer in the letermovir group stopped the prophylaxis due to adverse events. There are some issues with the trial. They did not disclose the valganciclovir dosing, and it's possible that they used higher dosing and had a higher rate of neutropenia and leukopenia, as rates of both of those in this study were somewhat higher than what is seen and what was seen in other clinical trials. But nonetheless, this just show good safety and efficacy of letermovir, providing new options. Important to realize with letermovir that there's some drug interactions with tacrolimus, cyclosporine, and azoles, and the cost is quite significant at $277 a day for letermovir versus $4 a day for valganciclovir, according to GoodRx.com when I looked it up this month. And some people say, well, it's covered by insurance, so it's not an issue. But I think we need to think more about what that means when we're, it's about $20,000 for 3 months of therapy versus a lot less money for valganciclovir. So it's important to be good financial stewards as well as drug and diagnostic stewards. For antiviral prophylaxis after stem cell transplant, acyclovir, valacyclovir, or famvir is given to everyone to prevent disseminated zoster and also to prevent herpes. And duration varies a lot across programs and different protocols, but often it's 6 to 12 months or sometimes longer. Letermovir is often given for 100 days if higher CMV risk. And important to realize that who is high CMV risk after stem cell transplant? It's the opposite of organ transplant. So it's when the donor is negative and the recipient is positive. And I think that if you think about it, that means that the virus is in the recipient and you have taken away their immunity by ablating their bone marrow. And then you give them a naive or non-immune bone marrow from that donor. And that's the high-risk population. Be aware that letermovir effectively prevents CMV, but not HSV or zoster. There is a significant signal in multiple studies that it decreases mortality using letermovir. And do be aware that there can be these small viral blips that are important and could actually be testable on the boards. But basically, because it's a terminase chain inhibitor, it's considered normal to have these low-level DNA emias. And so usually we just retest a week later. Often we see them go away, and we would only recommend stopping therapy if the blips were high, in other words, greater than like 1,000 IU per mil. And just to highlight for these, for antiviral prophylaxis or treatment, letermovir, and I'll talk more about maribavir, are only for CMV. We've been pretty relaxed in that valganciclovir, ganciclovir cover CMV, HSV, VZV. And so we can forget that letermovir and maribavir really just cover CMV. So that's an important thing to think about. We usually throw in prophylaxis against HSV, VZV if we're using letermovir, and depending on the situation with maribavir treatment as well. When should we use letermovir prophylaxis? Well, definitely for stem cell transplant recipients at high to moderate risk. And then I think it's appropriate in solid organ transplant recipients who truly cannot tolerate valganciclovir. One of the highest risk populations would be short telomere syndrome lung transplant recipients because they have bone marrow suppression already, so they tend to not tolerate valganciclovir. And that actually, at my hospital, is the only indication to use letermovir up front. And then I find letermovir also very helpful as secondary prophylaxis after treatment of ganciclovir-resistant CMV. Okay, let's talk about pneumocystis and toxoplasmosis prophylaxis. This is a really important topic. Nothing saves more lives, I think, than for prophylaxis than trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. So that is first-line therapy, usually given as a trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole single strength daily or double strength 3 times a week. Renally adjusted as needed, but only renally adjusted for very low renal function. Second line therapies include etoveqone, 1500 milligrams a day, but realistically expensive and patients hate it and they don't necessarily actually take the drug. Dapsone would be yet another option, but we see toxicity, including hemolysis if they have G6PD deficiency, and you should also watch for methemoglobinemia. I guess that could be, both of those could be board's questions, the methemoglobinemia and G6PD deficiency with dapsone. We can also see white blood cell dyscrasias with very low white blood cell counts. Pentamidine intravenously once a month does not cover toxoplasmosis and is not very effective. And I think most programs have gotten away from that. Antifungal prophylaxis. So after solid organ transplant, there's a lot of variation outside of lung transplant. Most programs don't give much antifungal prophylaxis. But for lung transplant and intestinal transplant, they do. Lung transplant, they're often giving either posaconazole or isavuconazole or itraconazole for variable times after transplant. We had been using more voriconazole, but due to side effects, we've kind of gotten away from that. Antifungal prophylaxis is important after stem cell transplant. Many programs use fluconazole in the first 100 days, generally for higher risk recipients. Do know that this is the classic population in which we see Candida krusei that is resistant to fluconazole. And I think that would actually be a good board's question is, patient on fluconazole, Candida krusei, fungemia or whatever, how will you treat them? And you do need to know that Candida krusei is intrinsically resistant to fluconazole. Posaconazole is often reserved for higher risk patients. It is the only FDA-approved agent for this indication. When we were using voriconazole for prophylaxis, it was noted that we saw a higher risk of mucormycosis. And isavuconazole is not necessarily approved for prophylaxis, but is used pretty extensively due to decreased drug interactions and no QT interval prolongation. Just a couple of pearls on antifungal therapies. Voriconazole, when used longer term, there's a higher risk of skin cancers, higher risk of osteitis. And the little trick there is they have high fluoride levels. The patients are in exquisite total body pain from this osteitis. They can also get pseudoporphyria in sun-exposed skin, which is a bad bubbly rash. Voriconazole is usually the best upfront pick for Scedosporium infections as part of initial therapy. It does not cover mucormycosis, and levels can be variable, so you do need to trend levels over time. Isavuconazole has lower drug interactions and QT prolongation, but we do see breakthrough candidiasis. And so do be aware of that. That is a fairly routine thing we see that is disconcerting. And then posaconazole usually covers mucormycosis and sometimes with lower MICs than isavuconazole. I tend to reach for posaconazole for true infections. The sources of infection after transplant are extensive. Of course, you're aware of community-acquired and nosocomial or hospital-acquired prior colonization for things like Aspergillus or resistant bacteria can flourish in this setting. There can also be emerging infections. This is where we might see something like West Nile or other things that we weren't aware of in the community, but appear in this immunocompromised population. And then very important to think about the risk of donor-derived infection, and that might be from the organ graft or blood products or the stem cell transplant, but do always think about donor-derived infection in the transplant population. Over the past almost 20 years, very good data in the United States about donor-derived infection through organ transplantation. The overall risk is about 0.2% of transmission of donor-derived disease. It can be all types of infections. And so do be aware of this. One of the most important things is when you suspect a donor-derived infection, it is imperative that you report to the local organ bank wherever the organs came from so that they can notify the other centers and potentially save lives. So this is a really important topic that when you are suspicious of a donor-derived infection, ask your local organ procurement organization how the other recipients are doing. And then if you have a bug that you think is donor-derived, notify the OPO so they can alert the other centers. Something I think we don't think enough of is the severe transfusion-transmitted infections in both, well, this can be in solid organ or stem cell transplant recipients. We often think about HIV, hepatitis B, and hepatitis C, but those happen at lower rates than 1 in a million. Things we might not think about enough would be West Nile virus or yellow fever vaccine virus or HIV or Trypanosoma cruzii. There is some testing, but do be aware that the testing can be imperfect. We can also see transmission of bacteria, which is actually the most common transmission through blood products. And I don't think any of us really think about this as much as we wish we did when I bring it up. Okay, let's talk about syndromes of infection after transplant. So CMV is one of the most common pathogens after transplant and considered one of the great masqueraders. It's a range of disease from asymptomatic viremia to CMV syndrome to end organ disease with colitis, pneumonitis, retinitis, et cetera, that can be seen. Generally, best diagnosed by CMV PCR testing or DNAemia or viral load testing, which are pretty much all the same thing, nucleic acid testing. Usually best treated with valganciclovir or ganciclovir intravenous. Here's the standard treatment for what we do at Massachusetts General Hospital, which pretty much mirrors the fourth international guidelines. But for mild to moderate disease, we use oral valganciclovir, test weekly. Hopefully they have resolution of infection. If they have severe life-threatening, sight-threatening disease or high viral load, like greater than 50,000 IU per mil, we then admit to hospital for intravenous ganciclovir. We think about lowering immunosuppression. That's not always appropriate for sight-threatening, light-threatening disease. It may be. And then if they have hypogammaglobulinemia, sometimes we replete them with either IVIG or CMVIG, more for severe disease. And then if we don't see a good response to treatment, either clinically or based on blood work, we do want to think about the risk of CMV resistance, and perhaps we should send CMV resistance testing. Please know that at week one, we often see an increase in the CMV viral load. So that is not necessarily resistance. That is expected. We think it's basically you're measuring DNA in blood, not really viremia, but DNAemia. And if you have massive lysis of virus, it makes sense that at week one, your DNAemia may go up, and hopefully it goes down by week two. And for some people, after the end of appropriate treatment, if it seems like they are higher virologic risk for recurrence, we sometimes do secondary prophylaxis or we do weekly monitoring for 8 to 12 weeks. In the modern era, we have these ultra-sensitive assays, and there's a lot of discussion around what to do with very low viral load cases. And by very low, I mean less than 500 to 1,000 IU per mil on plasma or whole blood. Often, treatment may not be indicated. And with very low viral loads, I often think, like, who are they? What is the risk for explosive infection in the next week? You know, what is their net state of immunosuppression? Do they have a low absolute lymphocyte count? And can I do repeat testing reliably? But most of the time, if it's low, I just recommend retesting in a week. The one time I do start a treatment is if it's donor positive, recipient negative. They are probably non-immune and probably going to have true infection. I wanted to highlight that within the past few years, we've had the development of and release of maribavir for refractory CMV infection, and overall much better outcomes looking at maribavir compared to foscarnet and other investigator-assigned therapies. It's great to have an oral option rather than admitting people to hospital for intravenous ganciclovir or foscarnet, et cetera. So this has really been a game changer. And with the most recent version of the CMV guidelines, we have this nice algorithm for management of resistant refractory disease. You do not need to know this for the boards for sure. Although you might need to know that maribavir would be an agent that you could pick for resistant refractory CMV. One of the issues is that we do recommend it with lower viral loads, like less than 50,000 IU per mil. Otherwise, we are seeing significant rates of maribavir resistance. And this algorithm, I think, is the most heavily referenced figure in the guidelines. Do know that it is available for you, but do not memorize this for the boards. Just to highlight yet another virus, and a pesky one at that, would be BK polyomavirus that can cause BK nephropathy. One of the things that came out of our most recent guidelines is that screening for BK is imperative, and all kidney transplant programs must be screening for BK. If they're not, they really need to get on that. We have recommended algorithms for routine screening in the first 2 years after transplant in the guidelines. And then, although there's a lot of noise around leflunomide and sadafovir and other things, none of those really work. We don't recommend them. The only proven therapy is reduction of immunosuppression. I don't think this would be on the boards necessarily. This is sort of more nephrology, but if anyone asks you, reduction of immunosuppression is key and the rest is not proven. Oh, let's go on to measles. It's been a brisk year for measles already. Last year was a brisk measles, and I did want to highlight that for immunocompromised, this can be a big deal. Hopefully, people are well vaccinated prior to undergoing immunosuppression. Otherwise, if they, I just wanted to highlight post-exposure prophylaxis. So, with significant measles exposure, the CDC recommendations are that severely immunocompromised patients should receive IVIG regardless of immunologic or vaccination status. So do be aware of this situation. We recently developed our own local measles post-exposure prophylaxis protocol, which is based on the CDC recommendations as well as NACI guidelines from Canada and other guidelines. But it's important to have this because there's probably measles disease coming to you sometime soon. And to highlight that post-exposure prophylaxis, there are a lot of things that will be challenging. IVIG 400 milligrams per kilogram would take the better part of a day to infuse. That would need to be done under strict respiratory infection control. Measles is highly contagious, and you don't want to have multiple immunocompromised patients in the same infusion suite. This will require an infusion suite or hospital level care, so that's a lot. The cost is somewhere just for IVIG alone, in the $2,500 to $10,000 range, and maybe more. Local IVIG supplies may not be robust enough for everyone if there's an outbreak, and then we don't know how long IVIG covers for, but if it's an ongoing outbreak, people with multiple exposures, they may have to get more than one dose of IVIG. So this is, if you're kind of nervous having me talk about this, yes, this is not a good situation at all. Okay, let's talk about the so-called dreaded pulmonary nodule. So again, for the boards and clinical medicine, consider the prophylaxis and what's not covered by prophylaxis. So if they're on an antifungal, it's probably not something that would have been covered by that antifungal agent. So let the prophylaxis and epidemiology drive your differential diagnosis. So who gets fungal infections? Certainly, all transplant patients can get all types of fungal infections as listed here, including cryptococcal disease, invasive aspergillosis, and mucormycosis. We do see a fair amount of this. Diagnostics. Good to get tissue and then do fungal stains and cultures, tissue or bronchoscopy. fungal stains in culture, notify the lab not to mince the specimen if there's a suspicion of mucormycosis, as it won't grow if it's ripped apart. I always think about don't ripping off the mucormycosis arms and legs because it can't grow. That's kind of a hopefully a good visual or bad visual for you. And then fungal isolators, blood cultures are very rarely positive. Candida will grow in routine cultures. Histoplasma may be slightly better in dedicated fungal isolators, but overall blood culture is not so helpful for this. And pathology is really important, and I often speak in detail with my local pathologist and ask for special stains and whatnot, depending on how things are looking. Fungal markers on blood are often overrated, except for cryptococcal antigen is quite good, high sensitivity specificity. 1,3-beta-D-glucan, not great as a fungal marker, not great at all. It is a lower sensitivity, moderate specificity, lots of noise. It is excellent for pneumocystis, and otherwise, please don't rely on it. And it is often quite befuddling. Galactomannan on blood and Aspergillus PCR on blood have low sensitivity, high specificity, and have higher sensitivity on body fluids such as BAL. So think about that. And then Carius, you know, the cell-free DNA testing is emerging, and it is a somewhat higher sensitivity with proven versus probable disease. So far, I think this is emerging technology, extremely expensive. Many of us don't have ready access to it, perhaps appropriately, and important to use it in the right setting. Regarding antifungals in general, here's a great slide written by my colleagues within MGB infectious disease. And what I like about this slide is it talks about all the different mechanisms of action. But if you're a little bewildered by the new agents that are either available or for research purposes, you can see them highlighted here in red. So I think this is a nice reference when you're wondering what's new and maybe what should you be applying for access for with specific high-risk situations. These in red will not be on the boards by definition. Okay, let's do a couple of clinical cases. The first is a 54-year-old woman with a history of primary systemic AL amyloidosis complicated by cardiac amyloid. She was treated and then underwent heart transplant in February 2016. She then underwent autologous stem cell transplant. Unfortunately, the day she went for stem cell transplant, her CMV viral load was 29,000. She had neutropenic sepsis with bacteremia with strep salivarius and ongoing fevers and developed a 2-centimeter pulmonary nodule. And there it is, her 2-centimeter pulmonary nodule. After ordering the bronchoscopy, what is the next best step? And should you do voriconazole, posaconazole, or isavuconazole, start amphotericin B, start in echinocandin, or do combination therapy? And I think probably here I often will start combination therapy, sometimes posaconazole and amphotericin B, or sometimes amphotericin B and an echinocandin, but it could be so many things. What the team did for this case was they started voriconazole, but you will see that when she had the bronchoscopy, they saw non-septate hyphae, so this is likely mucormycosis or zygomycetes. And so we stopped the voriconazole, put her on isavuconazole and ambisome, and she had a rapidly growing lesion. This is, we asked thoracic surgery to take her to the operating room. I always say, if I ask thoracic surgery to take her to the operating room, maybe I should be in the operating room to show solidarity, support, and to see what they're doing. There it is. There's the pulmonary nodule. And then here is the mucormycosis seen on special stain, GMS stain. And yes, she had rhizopus species, and we gave her good treatment. And then she did quite well with treatment and eventually came off therapy. She subsequently developed disseminated zoster as she wasn't taking acyclovir prophylaxis. Anyway, so she did quite well. That last case highlights the importance of really getting a tissue diagnosis because voriconazole was definitely the wrong answer. What about this case? So this is somebody who had multiple myeloma, heavily treatment exposed, very immunocompromised, had a CAR T cell therapy and was on fluconazole and acyclovir prophylaxis. We were called because he had this new thick-walled, multiloculated cavitary lesion in the right upper lobe with ground glass and clustered nodularity. Could be many things. So we saw him. Did not have really interesting epidemiologically, had done some dirt biking and hiking. He'd been to Australia, overall pretty low risk. So what would you do for that? Who knows? What do we think it is? Do we start voriconazole? Do we start the old vancomycin? Do we start azithromycin? Do we start all of the above or do a bronchoscopy? And it's okay to say D and E. Okay. This case turns out to be Pseudomonas, and all the other testing was negative. I will say I've gotten burned so many times where I thought it was fungal or maybe mycobacterial, and it's the old Pseudomonas. So just be aware that, so important to make a diagnosis. Pseudomonas would not respond to the voriconazole. So I've, learned these are my trickier cases. This is another very interesting case, 73-year-old man who lived in Vermont, admitted with fevers, weight loss, diarrhea, cough, and a pulmonary mass after heart transplant. You can see here on the left side there, there's this pulmonary nodule, and then this is getting bigger, and he's basically admitted for an rapidly enlarging pulmonary nodule. He'd had this workup. The respiratory viral panel was negative, stool negative, galactomannan negative, beta-D-glucan negative, EBV PCR low positive at 1200 IU per mil. CMV DNA was negative. Respiratory culture grew Yersinia enterocolitica, which I, promptly said, like, well, that's not a respiratory bug, right? So that's of no significance, right? Also, the stool culture was negative. Stool PCR had been negative, for what that's worth. He was started on cefepime and amphotericin B, and a lung biopsy was performed. And what was really tricky about this case was it looked as though it could be an early EBV post-transplant lymphoma. And we spent a long time with pathology discussing this. The lung biopsy culture grew again, Yersinia enterocolitica. So at this point, I felt like I really had to focus on treatment. He did very well with treatment of the Yersinia in his lung. Nothing else grew. And then everything resolved, including the possible PTLD. And we do know that early PTLD can resolve with reduction of immunosuppression. So he did quite well overall, as you can see here. And I was humbled and will learn to pay attention to things like Yersinia in respiratory cultures as a possible pathogen. Yet another case of pneumonia in a heart transplant patient who'd had kidney failure, so wasn't on trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. She developed this new nasty pulmonary infection. So what is the cause here? And so she's highlighting she's not on trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. So what's this going to be? Nocardia nova. Okay, there you go. So this is the type of thing, again, look at the prophylaxis and think about what the likely answers are. One last case. This is a 42-year-old woman who underwent liver transplant. She was given 3 months of antiviral prophylaxis with valganciclovir and 6 months of trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. 2 months later, she presents. She has this painful rash on her finger with red streaking up her arm. What treatment would you start? And, I've listed several things there. I hope you're able to make a better answer because I was sort of really puzzled. We unroofed this, we sent it studies, and lo and behold, cultures grew staph epi, who cares? Serum cryptococcal antigen was negative, fungal cultures were negative, but this was HSV2 PCR positive. So this was herpetic Whitlow from HSV2. And I was truly humbled. I'd actually started her on linezolid. Yes. So the important issue here, the pearl here, is always, always, always try hard to get a diagnosis. You will always be surprised in transplant patients. Let's quickly switch to parasites. Toxoplasmosis is a significant pathogen, especially in stem cell transplant recipients, not so much in organ transplant recipients. About 10% of the US population is Toxoplasma PCR seropositive, and it can cause a variety of syndromes after transplant, ranging from encephalitis to pneumonitis to myocarditis and chorio retinitis. Toxoplasma PCR is a good test to send either on blood, CSF, BAL, or tissues. Serology is not usually that helpful. And this is really a pearl because if you're not sure what to do, you know, when you're kind of reaching for like what might be happening with my patient, Toxoplasma PCR is a good pearl to think about. And I'm always happy when I remember to send this one with, you know, an unclear diagnostic scenario. Another a classic clinical vignette, someone I saw, a 64-year-old man from the Dominican Republic with end-stage liver disease, chronic abdominal pain listed for liver transplant, eosinophilia up to 70% for 6 months, recurrent enteric gram-negative bacteremias, fluffy pulmonary infiltrates. What does he have? Well, this would be strongyloidiasis. His antibody was positive and he got treatment and actually did quite well. Strongyloides is common throughout much of the world, up to a 50% or higher mortality rate with disseminated disease in immunocompromised patients. And do be aware that in the center of this slide, there's this autoinfection loop. So even if someone is exposed 50 years or more ago, it can reactivate. And we saw that during the pandemic in, say, soldiers who'd been to Vietnam, and other unexpected surprises. So I say this is a little like a parasitic tuberculosis. It can and will reactivate even decades later. Here are the areas throughout the world where there is strongyloides. So you should be doing a good screening of those regions. Also think about donors from those regions. It is recommended that we be screening all donors for strongyloides, although I don't believe that's happening through all organ transplant centers, but low threshold to send appropriate diagnostics for this. We had a very interesting case a couple of years ago at Mass General where overnight the on-call ID fellow called me to say the outside hospital says there are parasites in this kidney transplant recipient coming into Mass General. What do you think? And I, you know, parasites in the sputum to me is almost always strongyloides until proven otherwise. This is how he presented with that CT scan and that abdominal rash. And those are some of the biopsy results. This was donor-derived disseminated strongyloides. And one of the nice things that came out of this New England Journal CPC is Alan Sanders, who was at, who's in Albany Medical Center, said that when he got the call from the organ procurement organization that our recipient had donor-derived strongyloides, most likely, he checked his recipient and said that that phone call was life-saving because he felt that he got the treatment into the patient much earlier than he would have otherwise. So just stressing the importance of excellent communication. Diagnostic stewardship, you know, think hard about the best methods to achieve the most likely diagnosis. Look for, you know, is it Hickam's dictum versus Occam's razor? And, you know, these patients can have multiple diagnoses at once. So Hickam's dictum may apply more frequently than Occam's razor. The initial workup can be protocol driven. We have syndromic evaluations in the emergency room to help guide initial workup, and that really cuts down on inappropriate diagnostics. Molecular diagnostics are generally superior to serology. Multiplex testing can help. I talked about non-invasive fungal diagnostics. The importance of Toxoplasma PCR can be quite good, rarely seen, but worthwhile sending, significantly sensitive, even if it's not seen so much. And think about cell-free DNA testing, but the sooner we have a diagnosis, the sooner we can stop broad-spectrum antimicrobials and better outcomes for the patient. I also just wanted to mention for transplant ID, drug interactions are really important. So think hard about this. Talk to your pharmacy team. Think hard about how you're going to make adjustments. And this is a major safety situation. I think that you may need to know this for the board. So azoles can make the tacrolimus or cyclosporin or rapamycin sirolimus levels go way up, 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 up. So they can be toxic on an azole. And then rifamycins, especially rifampin, can profoundly decrease tacrolimus and cyclosporine levels such that they can precipitate rejection. So I say when I start treatment for TB or other things, I worry about rejection. And when I start azoles for fungal infection, I worry about toxicity. But that's probably worth memorizing for the boards. A lot of what I do is turning a no into a yes. People think that I end up saying no to a lot of things. I'm actually trying hard to get everybody to say yes. And can we use higher risk donors? Can we make someone who's too sick for transplant healthy enough to undergo a life-saving transplant? And then post-transplant, how can they return to basically a normal life, work, school, foreign travel, have a healthy sex life? Do safe gardening, hiking, all the things they want to do. And a lot of this is education and counseling. There are a lot of guidelines that have been released in recent years, and I'd like to highlight that the American Society of Transplantation Infectious Disease Community of Practice will have updated guidelines, hopefully published later this year, that should be quite helpful. And there are a lot that come out from the stem cell transplant world as well. So, just in summary, the cardinal rules of immunosuppression and infection for 2026. Immunosuppression and infections are not always straightforward. It's important to be prepared to be surprised and think broadly. Don't hesitate to reach out to a colleague to discuss the case. Don't hesitate to reach out to the transplant team to discuss the case. Really important, number three, to prepare the patient before the immunosuppression starts, especially before solid organ transplant. We don't often have that window before stem cell transplant, but there's a strong role for infectious disease specialists. And I'm happy to talk to you more. You're welcome to email me, and I can give you details on our pre-transplant evaluation program. Prophylaxis and vaccines really alter the risk equation, and really important to get that right, both for primary and secondary prophylaxis, but prevention. And then consider the source of the infection. Is it a donor-derived infection? Could it be from the recipient? Is it from blood products? Is it geographic? We do see more antimicrobial resistance. So think hard about the source of the infection and the fact that if you notify others who may have received either similar organ or trans organ transplants from the same donor, that you could save lives. Thanks a lot for your attention, and I'm happy to have questions at the course, or you're welcome to email me.